before noon. It climbed at a slightly higher angle than it was supposed to, driving number 61 back into his couch with a force of 17 Gs, i.e. 17 times his own weight, 5 Gs more than anticipated. His heart rate shot up as he strained against the force, but he didn't panic for a moment. He had been through this same sensation many times on the centrifuge. As long as he just took it and didn't struggle, they wouldn't zap all those goddamn blue bolts into the soles of his feet. There were a lot of worse things in this world than G-forces. He was weightless now, hurtling toward Bermuda, and they flashed the lights in his cubicle, and the ape's pulse returned to normal, to no more than what it was on the ground. The usual shit was flowing. The main thing was to keep ahead of those blue bolts in the feet. He started pushing the buttons and throwing the switches like the greatest electric Wurlitzer organist who ever lived. Never missed a signal. Then the Mercury Retro rockets were fired automatically, and the capsule came down through the atmosphere at the same angle at which it had gone up. Another 14.6 Gs hit number 61 on the way down, making him feel as if his eyeballs were coming out of his head. He had been through so-called eyeball-out Gs too many times on the centrifuge. It could get a lot worse. There were worse things than feeling as if his eyeballs were coming out. The goddamn zap plates on his feet, for a start. So far as a mere spaceflight was concerned, number 61 was fearless. The beast had been operantly conditioned, aerospatially desensitized. The high angle of the launch also caused the capsule to overshoot the planned splashdown area by 132 miles. So it took 2 hours for a Navy helicopter crew to find the capsule out in the Atlantic and bring it aboard a recovery ship. The capsule and the ape were riding up and down in 7-foot swells. Water had begun to seep in where the landing bag had torn loose in the heavy seas. The capsule was wheezing and gurgling with water and pitching up and down like a ball in the waves. It wouldn't have stayed afloat too much longer. 800 pounds of water had seeped in. For the ordinary prudent human being, it would have been 2 hours of freaking terror. They brought the capsule to a recovery ship, the Donner, and opened it and brought out the ape's cubicle and opened the hatch. The ape was lying there with his arms crossed. They offered him an apple, and he took it and ate it with considerable deliberation, as if gloriously bored. Those 2 hours of being slung up and down in the open sea in 7-foot gulps inside a closed coffin-like cubicle had been perhaps the best time in this miserable land of the white smocks. No voices, no zaps, no bolts, no lengths of hose, no more breaking of his bloody balls. There was great elation among the astronauts and almost everyone involved in Project Mercury. There seemed to be no way that Kennedy and Wisner could intervene and keep them from trying at least one man flight. The pall of the day the cork popped had been removed. Late the next day, they flew number 61 back to the Cape and Hangar S, where a great mob of reporters and photographers were now waiting out in the compound by the Mercury capsule that had been used for the training. The vets led the ape out of a van. As the mob closed in and the flash bulbs began exploding, the animal, brave little Ham, as he was now known, became furious. He bared his teeth. He began snapping at the bastards. It was all the vets could do to restrain him. This was immediately, on the spot, interpreted by the press, the seemly gent, as an understandable response to the grueling experience he had just been through. The vets took the ape back inside the van until he calmed down. Then they let him out again, trying to get him near a mock-up of a Mercury capsule where the television networks had set up cameras and tremendous lights. The reporters and photographers surged forward again, yammering, yelling, exploding more camera lights, shoving, groaning, cursing, the usual Yahoo sprawl in short, and the animal came unglued again, ready to twist the noodle off anybody he could get his hands on. This was interpreted by the gent as a manifestation of Ham's natural fear upon laying eyes once again on the capsule, which looked precisely like the one that had propelled him into space and subjected him to such severe physical stresses. The stresses the ape was reacting to were probably of quite another sort. Here he was, back at the compound, where they had zapped him through his drills for a solid month. Just 2 years ago, he had been captured in the jungles of Africa, separated from his mother, shipped in a cage to a goddamn desert in New Mexico, kept prisoner, prodded, and shocked by a bunch of humans in white smocks, and here he was, back at a compound, where they had been zapping him through their fucking drills for a solid month, and suddenly, there was a whole new mob of humans on hand. Even worse than the white smocks. Louder, crazier, totally out of their gourds. Yammering, roaring, brawling, exploding lights beside their bug-eyed skulls. Suppose they threw him to these assholes. Fuck this! At some point in the madhouse scene out back of Hangar S, a photograph was taken in which Ham was either grinning or had a grimace that looked like a grin in the picture. Naturally. This was the picture that went out over the wire services and printed in newspapers throughout America. Such was the response of the happy chimpanzee to being the first ape in outer space. A fat, happy grin. Such was the perfection with which the proper gent observed the proprieties. Well, there were some big grins, all right, up in the high desert at Edwards among the brethren. Here were some men who had something to smile about. Now, the whole business of Project Mercury was no doubt clear to everyone. No one, not even in the general public, could possibly miss the point now. It was that obvious. The first flight, the coveted first flight of the new bird, that full-bore first flight that every test pilot strove for, had just been made in Project Mercury, and the test pilot was an ape. An ape made the first flight. A college-trained chimpanzee, to use the very words that they had heard astronaut Deke Slayton himself use before the Society of Experimental Test Pilots. And the ape had performed flawlessly, done as well as any man could possibly have done, for there was nothing for a man to do in the Mercury system except push a few perfunctory buttons and switches. This any college-trained chimpanzee could do also. He had missed a beat. Give him a signal and he'll toggle you a switch. To see the point, and surely all the world now saw the point, you only had to imagine sending an ape up for the first flight of the X-15. You would have a $20 million hole in the ground and a pulverized ape. But in Project Mercury, an ape was fine. First rate. In fact, the ape was an astronaut. He was the first one. Perhaps the female ape who backed him up deserved the next flight. Let her fly, goddammit. She has earned it as much as the seven human ones. She's been through the same training and so forth and so on. The brethren let their beer call brains soar. Perhaps the ape would go to the White House and get a medal. Why not? Perhaps the ape would address the September meeting of the Society of Experimental Test Pilots in Los Angeles. Why not? Another astronaut had done it, Deke Slayton, without flying at all. Oh, it was a laugh and a half, the whole thing. For now, the truth was out. It was obvious in a way that no one in the world could miss. And in the days that followed, the first days of February 1961, the True Brothers waited for the revelation to sweep across the press and the public and the Kennedy administration and the military brass. But strange to say, there was not even one such sign anywhere. In fact, they could begin to see signs of something quite the opposite. It was incredible. But the world was now full of people who were saying, "My God, do you mean there are men brave enough to try what the ape has just gone through?" John Glenn found himself in a ridiculous situation. It was nothing less than a charade. He had to pretend to be in the running for the first flight, and then he would read in the newspapers that he was the front runner. Since he had always been the fair-haired boy of the seven, that was the way it kept coming out. He and Gus Grissom had to tag along with Shepard through the training grind to keep up the fiction that the decision had not yet been made. In fact, Shepard was now the king, and Al knew how to act like the king. His Majesty the Prime Pilot, and Glenn was just a spear carrier. Yet the charade, which Gilruth himself insisted on, also offered Glenn one last chance. No more than a handful of people knew that Shepard had been chosen for the first flight. Therefore, it was not too late to change the decision to rectify what Glenn viewed as the incredible and outrageous business of the peer vote. But if this meant going over someone's head in one way or another, well, in the military, it was a grave error, a serious breach of all that was holy to go over the head of a superior unless, one, it was a critical situation and you were in the right, and two, your brash move worked, i.e., those at the top backed you up. On the other hand, there was nothing in the Presbyterian faith, another code Glenn knew very well, that said you had to stand around shy and obedient while the Pharisees waffled and oscillated, making imaginary snowballs. And was not NASA a civilian agency? God knew it was not run like the Marines. Glenn seemed to favor the Presbyterian course. He began talking to people in the hierarchy, asking what they thought of the decision. He did not argue that he should be the one who was chosen, or not in so many words. He argued that the choice could not be made from a narrow perspective. America's first astronaut would not be merely a test pilot with a mission to carry out. He would be a historic representative of America, and his character would be viewed in that light. If he did not measure up to that test, it would be unfortunate not only for the space program, but for the nation. The new administrator of NASA, appointed by Kennedy to replace T. Keith Glennon, was James E. Webb, a former oil company executive and a political grandmaster in the Democratic Party. Webb was of a valuable breed well-known in Washington, the off-the-ballot politician. The off-the-ballot politician usually looked like a politician, talked like a politician, walked like a politician, loved to mix with politicians, moved and shook with politicians, winked with politicians, sighed ruefully with them. He was the sort of man of whom a congressman or a senator was likely to say, "He speaks my language." The ablest and most distinguished of the off-the-ballot politicians, like Webb, were likely to end up with high-level appointments. Webb had been director of the Bureau of the Budget and undersecretary of state under Truman. He was also a great friend of Lyndon Johnson and Senator Robert Kerr of Oklahoma, who was chairman of the Senate Committee on Aeronautical and Space Sciences. For 6 years, Webb had been head of a subsidiary of the Kerr family's oil empire. Webb was the sort of man whom corporations doing work for the government, such as McDonnell Aircraft or Sperry Gyroscope, liked to have on their boards of directors. He looked the part. He had big, smooth jowls like Glennon's and even better hair, wavy, thick, as if every strand were nailed in, and dark, but graying smartly, and combed straight back in the manner favored by all serious men of the day. He had the sort of record that made him an ideal appointee to commissions like the Municipal Manpower Commission, which had occupied much of his time since 1959. He was known as a man who could make bureaucracies run. He was used to corner offices with terrific views. He was no fool. What would he have made of this business of astronaut Glenn's dissatisfaction with the selection of astronaut Shepard for the first Mercury flight? Gilruth said he had made the decision himself, and it was based on a wide range of criteria, many of them quite objective. Shepard had performed best on the procedures trainer, for example. When Gilruth considered all criteria, and not just the peer vote, Shepard ranked first and Glenn ranked second. So what was Glenn objecting to? It was a bit baffling, but one thing was for sure. Webb was not likely to start his tenure as administrator of NASA by taking a flying leap into some incomprehensible dogfight among the seven bravest lads in the history of the United States. Astronaut Glenn's objections and his last chance to become the world's first man in space simply sank without a bubble one day, and that was that. By now, late February of 1961, Glenn was not the only supremely miffed astronaut. Gilruth had finally published the names of the men who would make the first three flights: Glenn, Grissom, and Shepard, always in alphabetical order, implying that no decision had been made as to which of them would make the first flight, due to take place within 90 days. So Life ran a big story with pictures of Glenn, Grissom, and Shepard on the cover, with the headline, "The First Three." Life was really excited about the whole thing. They tried to get NASA to label the first three the Gold Team, and the rest of them the Red Team. The Gold Team and the Red Team, Jesus. The picture possibilities alone were fabulous. This being the fraternal bulletin, Life, the notion of the first three struck Slayton, Wally, Schirra, Scott Carpenter, and Gordon Cooper as a humiliation. In their minds, they were now labeled the other four. There were now the first three and the other four. They had been left behind. In some hard-to-define way, it was the equivalent of washing out. Life really did it up in the best Life style. They flew the first three and the first three wives and the first three children down to the Cape and took a lot of inseparable astronaut family pictures on Cocoa Beach. The results were bizarre evidence of a determination of the proper gent to make everything come out in a seemly fashion. For a start, the travel schedules of the astronauts had made an absolute hash of ordinary home life. To show three astronauts having an outing with their families at the same time, even in different locations, would have been stretching the truth considerably. To present such a spectacle at the Cape, which was, in effect, off-limits to the wives, was an absolute howler. On top of that, if you were going to put astronaut families together for a frolic on the beach, you could scarcely come up with a less likely combination than the Glens, the Grissoms, and the Shepherds. The clans of the Deacon, the Hoosier Grit, and the Icy Commander. They would have passed like ships in the night in even the calmest of times, and these were not the calmest of times. Not even Life, with all its powers of orchestration, and they were great, could make it come out right. They ran a big double truck picture of the first three and their wives and broods, the glorious first three tribe, out on the hardtack sands of Cocoa Beach, engrossed, the caption would have one believe, in the sight of an exploratory rocket rising from the base several miles away. In fact, they looked like three families from warring parts of our restless globe, who had never laid eyes on each other until they were washed up on this godforsaken shore together after a shipwreck, shivering morosely in their leisure togs, staring off into the distance, desperately scanning the horizon for rescue vessels, preferably three of them, flying different flags. As for the other four, they might as well have dropped through a crack in the earth. Glenn worked at being backup astronaut and charade master as if these were the roles the Presbyterian God had elected him to play. He gave it 100%, to use one of his favorite phrases. Besides, if, in the Lord's mysterious workings, it so happened that Shepard was not able to make the first flight for some reason or another, he would be 100% ready to step in. As a matter of fact, by April, it had become blessedly, healingly possible for a fighter jock like Glenn to swallow his personal ambitions and lose himself in the mission itself. A true sense of mission had taken over Project Mercury. The mighty Soviet Integral had just sent two more huge Korabls into orbit with dummy cosmonauts and dogs aboard, and both flights had been successful from beginning to end. The race was coming down to the wire. Gilruth had even considered sending Shepard up in March, but Wernher von Braun had insisted on one last test of the Redstone rocket. The test went perfectly, and everyone now wondered, in hindsight, if valuable time had been lost. Shepard's flight was scheduled for May 2nd, although it was not referred to publicly as Shepard's flight. The charade continued in full force, with Glenn still reading about himself in the newspapers as the likely choice. Around Hangar S, there were NASA people who were talking about bringing all three, Glenn, Grissom, and Shepard, out to the launch pad on May 2nd in their pressure suits with hoods over their heads so that no one would know who was taking the first flight until he was inside the capsule. The reason why it should even matter had been long since forgotten. NASA engineers and technicians at the Cape were pushing themselves so hard in the final weeks, people had to be ordered home to rest. It was a grueling time, and yet the sort of interlude of adrenal exhilaration that men remember all their lives. It was an interlude of the dedication of body and soul to a cause such as men usually experience only during war. Well, this was war, even though no one had spelled it out in just that way. Without knowing it, they were caught up in the primordial spirit of single combat. Just days from now, one of the lads would be up on top of the rocket for real. Everyone felt he had the life of the astronaut, whichever was chosen, only a few knew, in his hands. The MA-1 explosion here at the Cape 9 months ago had been a chilling experience, even for veterans of flight tests. The seven astronauts had been assembled for the event, partly to give them confidence in the new system. And their gullets had been stuck up toward the sky like everybody else's, when the whole assembly blew to bits over their heads. In a few days, one of those very lads would be lying on top of a rocket, albeit a Redstone, not an Atlas, when the candle was lit. Just about everybody here in NASA had seen the boys close up. NASA was a family that way. Ever since the end of the Second World War, the phrase government bureaucracy had invariably provoked sniggers. But a bureaucracy was nothing more than a machine for communal work, after all. And in those grueling and gorgeous weeks of the spring of 1961, the men and women of NASA's Space Task Group for Project Mercury knew that bureaucracy, when coupled with a spiritual motivation, in this case true patriotism and profound concern for the life of the single combat warrior himself, bureaucracy, poor, gross, hideously ridiculed 20th century bureaucracy, could take on the aura, even the ecstasy, of communion. The passion that now animated NASA spread out even into the surrounding community of Cocoa Beach. The grisliest down-home alligator-poaching crackers manning the gasoline pumps on Route A1A would say to the tourists as the no-knock flowed, "Well, that Atlas vehicle's giving us more fits than a June bug on a porch bulb, but we got real confidence in that Redstone, and I think we're gonna make it." Everyone who felt the spirit of NASA at that time wanted to be part of it. It took on a religious dimension that engineers, no less than pilots, would resist putting into words. But all felt it. Whoever had possessed any doubts about Gilruth's powers of leadership dismissed them now. He had all phases of Project Mercury coming together in a coda. His calmness was all at once like a seer's. Wisner, who had become Kennedy's cabinet-level science advisor, had ordered a full-scale review of the space program and its progress, meaning, of course, its lack of progress, and he, in a special committee under his jurisdiction, kept sending queries and memoranda to NASA about careless planning, disregard of precautions, and the need for an entire series of chimpanzee flights before risking the life of one of the astronauts. At Langley and at the Cape, they treated Wisner and all his minions as if they were aliens. They ignored their paperwork and didn't return their phone calls. Finally, Gilruth told them that if they wanted that many more chimpanzee flights, they ought to move NASA to Africa. Gilruth seldom said anything cutting or even ironic, but when he did, it stopped people in their tracks. The launch procedures were now rehearsed endlessly and with great fidelity. The three of them, Shepard, Glenn, and Grissom, were staying in motels in Cocoa Beach, but they would get up early in the morning before dawn, drive to the base, to Hangar S, have breakfast in the same dining room where Shepard would eat on the morning of the flight, go to the same ready rooms he would use on that morning for the physical exams and for putting on the pressure suit, have the biosensors attached and the suit pressurized, get into the van at the door and ride out to the launch pad, go up in the gantry elevator, get into the capsule on top of the rocket, and go through the procedures training. Abort! Abort! The whole thing. Using the actual instrument panel that would be used in flight and the actual radio hookups. All of this was done over and over. They were now using the capsule itself for simulation. just as the chimpanzees had. The idea was to decondition the beast completely so that there would not be a single novel sensation on the day of the flight itself. All three of them were taking part, but naturally Shepard, as prime pilot, no other word was used now, had precedence. And he took precedence. The little group in Hangar S now saw Al in both his varieties, and both were king, both the Icy Commander and Smilin' Al. Usually he left the Icy Commander back in Langley and brought only Smilin' Al to the Cape, but now he had both installed at the Cape. As the pressure built up, Al set a standard of coolness and competence that would be hard to top. In the medical examinations, in the heat chamber sessions, in the altitude chamber runs, he was as calm as ever. By now, the White House had become extremely jittery, fearing what the debacle of a dead astronaut would do to American prestige. And so some dress rehearsals were conducted on the centrifuge at Johnsville, with Al and his two charade hands, Glenn and Grissom, taking part, and Al was imperturbable. Likewise, in the 11th-hour simulations atop the rocket at the Cape, Al showed only one sign of stress. The cycles, Smilin' Al / Icy Commander, now came one on top of the other, in the same place, and alternated so suddenly that the people around him couldn't keep track. They learned a little more about the mysterious Al Shepard here in the 11th hour. Smilin' Al was a man who wanted very much to be liked, even loved, by those around him. He wanted not just their respect, but also their affection. Now in April, on the eve of the great adventure, Smilin' Al was more jovial and convivial than ever. He did his Jose Jimenez routine. The great grin spread wider and his great beer call eyes beamed brighter than ever before. Smilin' Al was crazy about a comedy routine that had been developed by a comedian named Bill Dana. It concerned the cowardly astronaut and was a great hit. Dana portrayed the cowardly astronaut as a stupid immigrant Mexican named Jose Jimenez, whose tongue wrapped around the English language like a taco. The idea was to interview astronaut Jimenez like a news broadcaster. You'd say things like, "What has been the most difficult part of astronaut training, Jose?"
"Obtaining the money, senor."
"The money for what?"
"For the bus back to Mexico, you betcha, real quick, senor."
"I see. Well, now, Jose, what do you plan to do once you're in space?"
"Gonna cry a lot, I think."
Smilin' Al used to crack up over this routine. He liked to do the Jose Jimenez part, and if he could get someone to feed him the straight lines, he was in seventh heaven, Smilin' Al version. Feed him the lines for his Jose Jimenez knockoff, and he'd treat you to the best beer call good buddy you ever had. Of course, the cowardly astronaut routine was also a perfectly acceptable way for bringing up on the oblique, as it were, the subject of the righteous stuff that the first flight into space would require. But that was probably unconscious on Al's part. The main thing seemed to be the good fun, the camaraderie, the closeness, and blustery affection of the squadron on the eve of battle. In these moments, you saw Smilin' Al supreme. And in the next moment, some poor Air Force lieutenant, thinking this was the same Smilin' Al he had been joking and carrying on with last night, would sing out, "Hey, Al! Somebody wants you on the phone!" And all at once there would be Al, seething with an icy white fury, hissing out, "If you have something to tell me, Lieutenant, you will call me Sir." And the poor devil wouldn't know what hit him. Where the hell did that freaking Arctic avalanche come from? And then he would realize that, all at once, the Icy Commander was back in town. Of course, those few who knew he was the man who was going up first were in a mood to forgive him all. Well, save for an astronaut or two. As for the NASA technicians and the military personnel assigned to the mission, they were in a mood of utter adoration of the single combat warriors. All three of them, for one of them would be placing his hide on top of the rocket and our rockets always blow up. Toward the end, the three of them would enter a room for some sort of test, and the technicians and workmen would stop what they were doing and break into applause and beam at them that warm, moist smile of sympathy. Without knowing it, they were bestowing homage and applause in the classic manner, before the fact. These little scenes pressed Glenn's powers as charade master to the limit. More of these warm beams would be aimed at him than at either of the other two. He was the one mentioned in the press as the most likely choice. Not only that, he was the warmest of the three, the most consistently friendly toward one and all when he ran into them. It was just about too much. He had to keep smiling and all shucking and playing Mr. Modest, just as if it might, in fact, be he who was going up on top of the rocket on May 2nd as the first man in the world to risk the mighty shot into space. And then the omnipotent Integral intervened, a practical joker to the end. Early on the morning of April 12th, the fabulous but anonymous builder of the Integral, chief designer of the Sputniks, struck another of his cruel but dramatic blows. Just 20 days before the first scheduled Mercury flight, he sent a 5-ton Sputnik called Vostok 1 into orbit around the Earth with a man aboard, the first cosmonaut, a 27-year-old test pilot named Yuri Gagarin. Vostok 1 completed one orbit, then brought Gagarin down safely, on land, near the Soviet village of Smelovka. The omnipotent Integral. NASA had really believed, and the astronauts had really believed, that somehow, in the religious surge of the mission, Shepard's flight would be the first. But there was no putting one over on the Integral, was there? It was as if the Soviet's chief designer, that invisible genius, was toying with them. Back in October 1957, just 4 months before the United States was supposed to launch the first artificial Earth satellite, the chief designer had launched Sputnik 1. In January 1959, just 2 months before NASA was scheduled to put the first artificial satellite into orbit around the sun, the chief designer launched Mekta 1 and did just that. But this one, Vostok 1, in April 1961, had been his pièce de résistance. Given the huge booster rockets at his disposal, he seemed to be able to play these little games with his adversaries at will. There was the eerie feeling that he would continue to let NASA struggle furiously to catch up, and then launch some startling new demonstration of just how far ahead he really was. The Soviets persisted in offering no information as to the chief designer's identity. For that matter, they identified no one involved in Gagarin's flight other than Gagarin himself. Nor did they offer any pictures of the rocket or even such elementary data as its length and its rocket thrust. Far from casting any doubt as to the capabilities of the Soviet program, this policy seemed only to inflame the imagination. The Integral. Secrecy was by now accepted as the Russian way. Whatever the CIA might have been able to do in other parts of the world, in the Soviet Union they drew a blank. Intelligence about the Soviet space program remained very sketchy. Only two things were known. The Soviets were capable of launching a vehicle of tremendous weight, 5 tons, and whatever goal NASA set for itself, the Soviet Union reached it first. Using those two pieces of information, everyone in the government, from President Kennedy to Bob Gilruth, seemed to experience an involuntary leap of the imagination similar to that of the ancients, who used to look into the sky and see a clump of stars, sparks in the night, and deduce therefrom the contours of an enormous bear, the constellation Ursa Major. On the evening of Gagarin's flight, April 12, 1961, President Kennedy summoned James E. Webb and Hugh Dryden, Webb's deputy administrator and NASA's highest-ranking engineer, to the White House. They met in the cabinet room, and they all stared into the polished walnut surface of the great conference table and saw the mighty Integral and the builder, the chief designer, who was laughing at them. And it was awesome. In Washington, at Langley, and at the Cape, NASA was deluged with telephone calls from newspaper, wire services, magazines, radio stations, and most callers wanted to know what the astronauts' reaction was to Gagarin's flight. So the first three, Glenn, Grissom, and Shepard, all prepared statements. Shepard cranked out something that said next to nothing at all, standard government issue. Privately, he was put out with Gilruth and von Braun and everyone else for not sending him up in March, as it now appeared they could have. As usual, it was Glenn whom the press quoted most. He as much as said, "Well, they just beat the pants off us, that's all, and there's no use kidding ourselves about that. But now that the space age has begun, there's going to be plenty of work for everybody." Glenn was considered especially forthright, gracious, and magnanimous. He was big about the thing, as the saying goes, and that seemed especially commendable, since he was still considered the American frontrunner for the flight that would have made him the first man in space. He had swallowed his own disappointment like a man. Chapter 10. Righteous Prayer. Alan Shepard finally got his turn on May 5th. He was inserted in the capsule, on top of a Redstone rocket, about an hour before dawn, with an eye toward a launch shortly after daybreak. But as in the case of the Ape, there was a four-hour hold in the countdown, caused mainly by an overheating inverter. Now the sun was up, and all across the eastern half of the country, people were doing the usual, turning on their radios and television sets, rolling the knobs in search of something to give the nerve endings a little tingle, and what suspense awaited them. An astronaut sat on the tip of a rocket preparing to get himself blown to pieces. Even in California, where it was very early, highway patrolmen reported a strange and troubling sight. For no apparent reason, drivers, hordes of them, were pulling off the highways and stopping on the shoulders as if controlled by Mars. The patrolmen were slow in figuring it out because they did not have AM radios, but the citizenry did, and they had become so excited as the countdown progressed at Cape Canaveral, so ravenously curious as to what would happen to the mortal hide of Alan Shepard when they fired the rocket. It was too much. Even the simple act of driving overloaded the nervous system. They stopped. They turned up the volume. They were transfixed by the prospect of the lonely volunteer about to be exploded into hash. This tiny lad, up on the tip of that enormous white bullet, appeared to have about one chance in 10 of living through it. Over the 3 weeks since the great Soviet triumph of Gagarin's flight, one terrible event had followed another. The United States had sent in a puppet army of Cuban exiles to conquer the Soviets' puppet regime in Cuba, and instead suffered the humiliation that became known as the Bay of Pigs. This had nothing directly to do with the spaceflight, of course, but it heightened the feeling that this was not the time to be trying brave and desperate deeds in the contest with the Soviets. The sad truth was, our boys always botch it. 8 days after that, on April 25th, NASA had another big test of an Atlas rocket. It was supposed to carry a dummy astronaut into orbit, but it went off course and had to be blown up by remote control after 40 seconds. The explosion nearly wiped out Gus Grissom, who was following the rocket's ascent as chase pilot in an F-106. 3 days after that, April 28th, a so-called Little Joe rocket with a Mercury capsule on top of it went off on another crazy trajectory and had to be aborted after 33 seconds. Both of these were tests of the Mercury Atlas system, which would be used for orbital flights, and they had nothing to do with the Mercury Redstone system, which Shepard would be riding. But it was far too late to make fine points. Our rockets always blow up, and our boys always botch it. And so now, on the morning of May 5th, thousands, millions stopped by the side of the road, paralyzed by the drama. This was the greatest death-defying hell driver stunt ever broadcast, a patriotic stunt, a hash-mad stunt bound up with the fate of the country. People were beside themselves. What must be going through the man's mind? Him and his poor wife. Then the radio announcer would tell how Shepard's wife, Louise, was following the countdown over television inside their home in Virginia Beach, Virginia. What a state the poor woman must be in, and so forth, and so on. Brave lad, he hasn't resigned yet. As for Shepard, what was going through his mind at that moment, and through much of his body, from his brain to his pelvic saddle, was a steadily increasing desire to urinate. It was no joke. He had been through 120 complete simulations of his flight, simulations that included the smallest details anyone could imagine. The early morning wake-up by the official astronaut physician, Dr. William Douglas, the physical exam, the attaching of all the biosensors, the slipping of the thermometer tube up the rectum and the putting on of the suit, the hooking up of the oxygen tube and the communications lead, the ride out to the launch pad, the insertion, as it was known, into the capsule, the closing of the hatch, the works. They even went through the process of sucking the air out of the capsule with a hose and pressurizing the interior with pure oxygen. Then Shepard would go through yet more simulated rides and aborts, using the capsule itself as if it was a procedures trainer. 3 days ago, it turned out, even the mental atmosphere of the real thing was simulated. It was 3 days ago, May 2nd, that Shepard was originally scheduled to be launched. The weather made it a doubtful proposition, but they went ahead with the countdown. And Shepard had dinner in crew quarters the night before the flight, with much comradely banter, and Dr. Douglas tiptoed into his room the next morning and woke him up. And then he had the pre-launch breakfast, steak wrapped in bacon, plus eggs, in fact. Shepard went through everything, right up to the point where he would have climbed into the van and ridden out to the rocket in the belief that this just might be it. Then the launch was postponed because of bad weather. Only at this point did NASA finally reveal that it was Shepard who had been assigned to the flight and was suited up and waiting behind the door in Hangar S. So Shepard had even been through the actual feeling of, this is the day. But no one had ever seriously envisioned the problem he now faced. There was no easy way out when one's bladder kept getting larger and the capsule kept getting smaller. The dimensions of this little pod had been kept as tight as possible in order to hold down the weight. Once the various tanks, tubes, electrical circuits, instrument panels, radio hookups, and so on were crammed in, along with the astronaut's emergency parachute, the space left over was not much more than a holster you could slip two legs and a torso into, with a tiny bit of room remaining for arms. The word they used, insertion, was not far off. The seat was literally a mold of Shepard's back and legs. They had packed the plaster right onto his body up at Langley Field. He was now in his seat, but resting on his back. It was as if a man were sitting in a very small sports car that had been upended so that it pointed straight up at the sky. In the rehearsals, Shepard had reached the point where he could slip into his slot with one continuous series of moves. But this time, for the real thing, he had on a new pair of white boots, and the boots slipped on the armrest of the couch when he was snaking his right leg into the capsule. That threw him off, and he wound up with everything inside except his left arm. The capsule was so small that getting his left arm inside became a terrific operation, with him wrenching this way and that and crewmen out on the gantry offering advice. Now he was so jammed in that the cuff on his right wrist, where his glove joined the sleeve of the pressure suit, kept catching on the parachute. He looked at the parachute and all of a sudden wondered what good it was. Technicians were craning in and fastening him to the couch with knee straps and lap belt and a chest strap and screwing hoses to his pressure suit to maintain the pressure and control the temperature and wiring up leads for the biomedical sensors and the radio hookup and attaching and sealing a hose to the faceplate of his helmet for oxygen. In all likelihood, if he ever needed the parachute, he'd be a hole in the ground before he could get all these rigs undone. Then they closed the hatch, and he could feel his heartbeat quicken. But it soon subsided, and he was stuffed into this little thimble, lying on his back, practically immobile, with his legs jackknifed. It was like being a China Cossack packed in a box full of styrofoam. His face was pointed straight up toward the sky, but he couldn't see it because he had no window. All he had were two little portholes, one on either side above his head. The true pilot's window and hatch wouldn't be ready until the second Mercury flight. He might as well have been inside a box. A greenish fluorescent light filled the capsule. He could see outside only through the periscope window on the panel in front of him. The window was round, about a foot in diameter, in the middle of the panel. Outside, in the dark, the launch crewman on the gantry could see the lens of the periscope if he pointed it their way. They kept walking in front of it and giving him big grins. Their faces filled the window. There was a wide-angle distortion so that their noses protruded about 8 feet out in front of their ears. When they grinned, they seemed to have more teeth than a perch. Once the dawn broke, he could look out of the periscope and turn it this way and that and see the Atlantic over there and some people down on the ground, although the perspectives were a bit strange because he was lying on his back and the periscope window was not terribly big and the angles were unusual. But then the sun grew brighter and brighter and he kept getting bursts of sunlight in the periscope window, lying on his back like this and looking up. And so he reached up with his left hand and clicked a gray filter into place. That helped a great deal, even though it neutralized most colors. Now that the hatch had been bolted shut, Shepard could hear practically nothing from the outside world except the voices that came over the headset inside his helmet. He spent part of the time, as before any test flight, going over his checklist. Over the headset came the voice of the leader of the launch pad team saying, "Auto retro jettison switch arm." And Shepard would say, "Roger. Auto retro jettison switch arm. Retro heater switch off." And Shepard would say, "Retro heater switch off. Landing bag switch auto. Landing bag switch auto." And on down the line. After a while, however, as the holes dragged on, people were coming on the circuit to keep him company and find out how he was bearing up. He could hear Gordon Cooper, who was serving as the CAPCOM, the capsule communicator in the blockhouse near the launch pad, and Deke Slayton, who would be the CAPCOM in the flight control center during the launch itself. Cooper had a telephone hookup with the capsule, and every now and then, Bill Douglas or another of the doctors would come on the line, apparently as much as to assess his spirits as anything else. Werner von Braun talked to him at one point. The countdown progressed very slowly. Shepard asked Slayton to have someone call his wife to make sure she understood the reasons for the delay, and then he was back in the tight little world of the capsule. There was an irritating tone, very high up in the audible range, coming over the headset the whole time, some sort of feedback sound apparently. He could hear the hum of the cabin fans and the pressure suit fans, both used for cooling, and he could hear the inverters moaning up and down. So here he was, stuffed into this little blind thimble, spliced into the loop by every conceivable sort of wire and hose leading from his body, his helmet, and his suit, listening to the hums, moans, overtones, and the minutes and the hours began to go by, and he'd swivel his knee and ankle joints a few centimeters this way and that to keep his circulation up, and two annoying little pressure points began to build up where his shoulders pressed back into the couch, and then the tide began to build up in his bladder. The problem was, there was nothing to urinate into. Since the flight would only last 15 minutes, it had never occurred to anybody to include a urine receptacle. Some of the simulations had dragged on for so long the astronauts had ended up urinating in their pressure suits. It had been the only thing to do, short of spending hours removing the man from all his hookups in the capsule and the suit itself. The chief danger in introducing liquid into a pure oxygen environment such as that of the capsule and the pressure suit was of causing an electrical short circuit that might start a fire. Luckily, the only wires that urine was likely to come in contact with inside the pressure suit were the low voltage leads to the biomedical sensors. And the procedure had seemed safe enough. There was even a sponge mechanism inside the suit for removing excess moisture, which ordinarily would come in the form of perspiration. Nevertheless, no one had seriously studied the possibility that on the day itself, the day of the first American manned spaceflight, the astronaut might end up on top of the rocket and stuffed into the capsule with his legs practically immobile for more than 4 hours with his bladder to answer to. There was no way the astronaut could simply urinate into the lining of the pressure suit and have it go unnoticed. The suit had its own cooling system, and the temperature was monitored by interior thermometers, which led to consoles, and in front of those consoles were some by now highly keyed-up technicians whose sole mission was to stare at the dials and account for every fluctuation. If a nice steaming subdermal river of 98.6 degrees was introduced into the system with no warning, the Freon flow would suddenly increase. Freon was the gas used to cool the suit, and well, God knew what would result. Would they hold up the whole production? Terrific. Then the number one astronaut could explain over a radio transmitter while the nation waited, while the Russians girded themselves for round two of the Battle of the Heavens, that he had just peed in his pressure suit. Compared to the prospect of such a flap, no matter how minor, in the final phase of the countdown, any possible danger of blowing up on the launch pad was far down an astronaut's list of worries. For a test pilot, the right stuff in the prayer department was not, "Please, God, don't let me blow up." No. The supplication at such a moment was, "Please, dear God, don't let me fuck up." To come this far and fuck up. All along, the constant fear of the righteous pilot was not of death, but of ending up where John Glenn was this morning, standing by as a mere spear carrier in the drama. You had to hand it to Glenn, however. He had really buckled down and worked like a Trojan as backup pilot during the last month of the training. He had really proved helpful. He had even come up with a little dawn patrol camaraderie this morning. Shepard was in a mood for that. Ever since he got up, he had been in his smiling owl of the Cape cycle. On the way out in the van, he had gotten Gus Grissom to play straight man for the Jose Jimenez routine. Shepard liked to do the Mexican accent the way Dana did it. "If you ask me what made you a good astronaut, I tell you that you had to have courage and the good blood pressure and the four legs."
"Four legs?" Gus asked dutifully.
"Well, it is a dog they want to sing, but they think that is too cruel."
Yes, they would remember him as having been loose as a goose on the way to the top of the rocket. When he came up the gantry elevator and stepped out to enter the capsule, Glenn was already up there, dressed in white like the technicians. He was smiling. When Shepard finally squeezed himself into the capsule and looked at the instrument panel, there was a little sign on it saying, "No handball playing in this area." That was Glenn's little joke, and he grinned and reached in and took the sign out. Actually, it was funny enough. "Too late, John. Shepard wasn't going to get run over or break a leg or be struck down by an angry god. He was in the capsule, and they were bolting the hatch, and all the others were left behind, out there, beyond the portal. There was no way a righteous pilot could have explained to anyone but another pilot what his feeling was, and of course, he would not have dared to try to explain it even to a pilot. The holy first flight, and he would be up there at the apex of the entire pyramid if he survived it. And if he didn't, this would have been even more difficult to explain. The evil odds were essential to the Enterprise. The unmentionable stuff, after all, involved a man hanging his hide out over the edge in a hurtling piece of machinery, and such unmentionable payoffs it brought you. One, which he had started receiving even before this morning, was a look. It was a look of fraternal awe, of awe in the presence of manly honor, that came over the faces of other men at the base when a test pilot or combat pilot headed for the aircraft for a mission when the odds were known to be evil. Shepard had rated that look before, particularly when testing overpowered, overweight jet fighters in their first carrier landings. It was the look that came over another man when one's own righteous stuff triggered his adrenaline. And this morning, every step of the way, from the crew quarters and hangar S to the gantry deck outside the capsule, where Glenn and the technicians had been waiting to help him inside, men had beamed that look straight at him, and then they had broken into applause. Just as he was getting ready to go onto the gantry and take the elevator up to the capsule, the entire ground crew had started applauding. They had that warm and humid smile on their faces, and tears glistened in their eyes, and they were banging their hands together and yelling things to him. Shepard had his helmet on with the visor sealed, and he was carrying his own portable oxygen unit, which was pumping away, and so it was all happening in a muffled pantomime. But there was no mistaking what was going on. They were giving him the applause and homage up front, come what may, payable in advance. From a sheerly analytical standpoint, one knew that the odds in this flight, while bad enough, were no worse than the odds he had faced before in testing winged aircraft. Wernher von Braun had said repeatedly that the Redstone rocket's record of reliability was 98%, which was better than that of some of the Century series of supersonic jet fighters during the test stage. But the truth was that by now Shepard would have accepted far worse odds. He had accepted a great many rewards up front. He and his confreres had already been lionized, such as few pilots in history. The very top pilots with the most righteous stuff were content to receive that unmentionable glistening look from aviators and support personnel at their own base. Shepard had already had it beamed upon him by every sort of congressman, canned food distributor, associated florist board chairman, and urban renewal speculator, not to mention the anonymous little cookies with their trimming little custards who simply materialized around you at the Cape. He had already accepted the payment up front, and millions of wide open human eyes were now upon him. The ancient instinct of a people, their so-called folk wisdom in the matter of the care, preparation, and recompense of single combat warriors was indeed sound. Like his predecessors in the ancient past, he had reached the blessed state where one was far more afraid of not delivering on his end of the bargain, having been paid up front, than he was of getting killed. Please, dear Lord, don't let me fuck up. He was now where he belonged and had striven to be, atop the very thrust point of the danger. He was now precisely at that critical elevation that separated the great pilots, bearing their gigantic, albeit invisible, picture of themselves from the mere mortals on the terrain below. No one would ever know whether or not another type of human being would have handled this day with the same aplomb. This day when one became the first human being ever to sit up on top of an 8-story-high bullet and have a 66,000-pound Redstone rocket lit under his tail. All the racing drivers, mountain climbers, scuba divers, bobsledders, and Seabees they once considered using, what would have been the state of their souls at this moment? Well, by now it was pointless to ask. One could only say this. For the typical competitive military pilot, possessing the regulation-issue heroic self-esteem of the breed, throbbing with rude animal health, convinced of his utterly righteous stuff, and ravenous for glory, which is to say, for a man like Alan Shepard, being where he was right now was his vocation, his calling, his holy beruf. He was home, upon the right stuff's highest elevations. On top of everything else, the organism's deconditioning was very nearly complete. After all the full dress rehearsals and simulations of this flight, complete with sounds, the G-forces, and even the wires protruding from his body, after more than 100 pre-creations of this moment, after riding up the gantry elevator over and over and fitting himself into the human holster and having them close the hatch and start the countdown, after lying in this very capsule day after day with the capsule's communicator's voice coming over his headset and the signals of flight flashing on the instrument panel until every inch and every second of the experience was familiar and the capsule had become more like an office than a vehicle, it was hard for a man to sense any difference this time in his own nervous system, even though intellectually
He knew that this was that day. Now and then he could feel the adrenaline building up, and his pulse rate increasing, and his breathing speeding up, and his heart palpitating slightly, and he would force himself to concentrate on the checklist, the console, the equipment connection.